We'll try that again, folks. Welcome. I'm going to call the meeting to order today, Wednesday, December 12th, Regent Candidate Advisory Council. Thank you for all the members for being here today. This is a we're pleased because we're fully appointed as of yesterday. So we have 24 out of 24, which is unique for us at this stage of the game. I know those of you that were just approved by the Senate Committee on Committees yesterday. I know you just got materials recently, so I apologize for that. It's probably like drinking out of a fire hose to see all of those applications, but that's the way we have to do it because of privacy laws. So I want to just start out by going around the room and doing the obligatory, everybody introduce themselves, particularly for those of you that are new appointees to the council. Just say who you are, where you're from, and a brief synopsis of who you are outside of this room, since many of us may not know you. Also, before we do that, I want to recognize our legislative members. We have both the chairs and ranking members of both the Senate and House Higher Education Committees, which I know those of you who've been here in the past know that was kind of the intent a couple cycles ago, but with transitions and committee assignments and stuff last time, it wasn't exactly that way. So we appreciate having them involved in this process because we will be looking to them for guidance, obviously. They're the ultimate deciders on the recommendations that we send up to the legislature, so they will help significantly in guiding this process and the work that we do. So let's start off. I'm going to start off at the end. Mr. Krause, welcome.
Hello, my name is Charles Krause. I am from Buffalo, Minnesota. I'm a dairy farmer. I graduated from the university in 1992, and I have a son that just graduated from the university 2 years ago, and my daughter is a senior at the university right now. So good to be here.
Morning. My name is Bill Otto, representing the 8th Congressional District. I live in very rural Park Rapids, so I'm a bit a ways away. And outside of here, I do government relations for a cooperative purchasing firm called Sourcewell.
Good morning. I'm John Englund. I lead government affairs for CHS. Prior to joining CHS, I led government affairs for Emory University in Atlanta, and prior to that, I was at in government relations at the University of Minnesota. And I'm happy to be here, and I also have to confess I have to leave early for a speaking engagement, so I'm sorry about that. Thank you.
I'm Margaret Carlson, Minnetonka, PhD, University 83, and I'm a consultant to higher education and nonprofits across the United States.
I'm Jerry Rogers. I'm a recently retired family physician from Moorhead. Actually, I had my degree before Margaret did from the university, and both of my kids also have degrees. And I think this is a good time. It must be my 10th year on the committee or something like that.
Good morning. My name is Greg Clausen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate, and I serve the communities of Apple Valley, Rosemont, Northeast Lakeville, and Coates. My background is in education. I was a secondary educator for 43 years, including 15 years as a principal in the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan Public Schools, and then 5 years as a district office worker in the same district doing federal and state grant work.
Good morning. I'm Jim Erickson. This is my fifth rodeo. In the middle of my second term, I'm a Senate appointee from the 5th District. I'm a lobbyist, a contract lobbyist, and so I work in these halls quite often. I graduated from the University of Minnesota Law School in 1969, so next year is my 50th anniversary of my law school class.
I'm Senator Paul Anderson, Senate District 44, representing the communities of Plymouth, Minnetonka, and Woodland.
Tim Hipsch, a 2007 grad of the Carlson School with an MBA. Been on this committee for 4 years now and work for General Mills.
Kathy Mattson, I'm from the 2nd District. I've been on this committee for about 6 years, 8 years, a while, seventh year. And I'm a U of M grad, both in secondary education and music.
And I'm Dan Walter. I am from Burnsville, also from the 2nd Congressional District. In my day job, I am a lobbyist for a biopharmaceutical company.
I'm Sally Olson, and I'm with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and I provide the staff support to this council.
Paul Taylor, Minnetonka. This is my fifth cycle. away from this job. On January 1st, I will start the 10th year of my fourth career. I'm a full-time volunteer, both business and community volunteering.
Good morning. I'm Connie Bernardi. I'm the incoming House Chair for the Minnesota House of Representatives, obviously, and I serve the communities of New Brighton, Fridley, and Spring Lake Park. Proud to be a University of Minnesota graduate, earned my BA degree some time back. And I really appreciate being appointed to this committee by our current speaker and look forward to participating with you in this important work.
My name is Stacia Wakefield. I'm from Buffalo, Minnesota, the 6th Congressional District. I am a 1994 graduate of the University of Minnesota. I've got a college freshman and one that will also be graduating this year and going on to college in the next fall. And I work as a mental health counselor in a private practice in Buffalo.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm from Apple Valley, Minnesota, and I go to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities studying political science, business management, and history.
Hi, I'm Barb Farrell. I'm from Eden Prairie, 3rd Congressional District, and this is my second rotation serving on this committee, and it's been my pleasure to, my background is technology consulting, but I've had the pleasure to volunteer for some initiatives that are very dear to me, and one that you might recognize as I was a founding board member of a nonprofit called Caring Bridge.
I'm Representative Bud Nornes from Fergus Falls. Had the pleasure for the last 4 years to chair higher education here in the House. My oldest son graduated from the university, from the Carleton Business College, has a master's degree there, and my granddaughter graduated in Duluth from the University of Duluth, so that's my connection to the university. The area I represent is Fergus Falls, about half of Otter Tail County, if you know where that is. 1,040 lakes up there if you want to go. The ice is pretty hard, but we had one that a guy unfortunately dropped through with his vehicle and his fish house the other day, so still not 100%. So.
My name is Quinton Moore. Good morning, everyone. From Minneapolis, right now I'm the Director of Annual Giving for the YMCA of the Greater Twin Cities, and just want to say thank you all for being here.
Good morning. My name is Bill Brady. I'm a 79 grad of the Carleton School and 80 grad of the MBA program over there. I live in St. Paul. I have four children, three of the four matriculated from the University of Minnesota, and I'm an attorney.
Good morning. I'm Drew Christensen. I live in Savage. I'm a realtor, and I graduated in 2015 from the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Well, again, thank you to everybody who is a new appointee and also to the returning members. We're going to move on to item 2 of the agenda, which is approval of the minutes from the September 18th meeting. Those should be in your packets. Any corrections or changes from members? If not, I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I don't know if that gap is needed, but we'll next, we have, I want to explain quickly the guest speaker situation. Since Representative Bernardi and Senator Anderson are now full-fledged members, we're going to take them off as guest speakers, and just so we're not repetitive and keeping in schedule. And also, I don't think we told you were speaking.
Oh, we did?
Oh, yeah. Anyway, we did. Sorry. But we do have Regent David McMillan, the chair of the Board of Regents. Those of you who are at the September meeting know that we had a staff presentation from the board on, I think, the work of the governance committee at the Board of Regents on, you know, qualities and what they're looking for in members of the Board of Regents. And today we'll hear from Chair McMillan. Mr. Chairman, welcome.
Good morning. Morning, Chair Walter. Thanks for the opportunity this morning to address all of you. And I have I want to go back over some of what you heard from Mr. Langworthy from our staff back in September, and I'll add a little of some current events flavor to that, and talk about some priorities and hopefully strike the right chord here that'll get a dialogue going, and you can ask me questions and quiz me a bit. Before I kick any of that off, though, a heartfelt thank you to all of you for the service you do and the important service. We have the 2019 cycle of elections coming, of course, and for the Board of Regents and the university as a whole, we have probably the most monumental and important decision that we make as a board shortly before us as we interview and vet a finalist candidate this week. We'll officially interview our finalist candidate, Joan Gable, on Friday, and then we, in all likelihood, will notice and schedule, or schedule and then notice, a special meeting of the board next week to make a final decision. So that momentous and consequential piece of governance called finding a new president rises above anything else we do as a board. But as significant and critical as that is, the work that the legislature has before it in the joint convention process in 2019, and the critical role that each of you play in helping frame that dialogue and vet candidates for the board, is perhaps more consequential and has an even longer term impact on the university as you think about a third of the Board of Regents, 4 of 12, who will hold 6-year terms. It's a very, very, very meaningful and consequential outcome for the long-term future of the organization. And as I think about the work that the board does and the highlighting that I think you're interested in me doing today from the standpoint of, you know, what does the Board of Regents look for in terms of members, new members, returning members, qualities, characteristics, capabilities of a third of the board, that long term and consequential, those words resonate. A third of the board is a significant piece of the board, and it is that intentional longevity with staggered 6-year terms that creates vision and governance leadership roles that transcend presidents. So case in point, I was elected in the 2011 election by the Joint Convention, and President Kaler started that July, and he was selected, I guess, November of 2010 by my predecessors, and now I'm in a term on the board that runs through 2022 or 2023, and there's my point. The decisions that you influence and the legislature makes outlast presidents in all likelihood, and I think as you think about the vetting process and the selection work that the legislature's asked you to participate in, that longevity, stability, and governance oversight, and keepers of the vision of what the university can and should be, probably are the most important things out there. So again, thank you for your service. You're all busy, you all have other things to do, and we're grateful. And for those of you that serve in this role and at the legislature and help lead that joint convention process, a double or triple or quadruple thank you. So we're very, very grateful. A couple words about the process with the new president. These regents, to the extent they are new or potentially returning, get the opportunity now that I so enjoyed, which is to start my career in governance at the university with a new president. That is a very, very big deal, and it's in many ways ideal because you get to help write the slate for what the priorities of the university and the new president are going to be. So I think I already walked through where we stand with our finalist, and without prejudging anything that will happen on Friday, I'm excited by the opportunity for the university. I'm excited by the transition path that we've helped create and that President Kaler has graciously helped us create with a thoughtful, planful, and well-communicated transition, both communicated inside the university to its many constituent groups, staff, faculty, students, and the many, many, many constituencies we have outside the university are getting a good look this week at exactly who this candidate is. So having President Kaler here through the end of June 2019 as the acting president, and then through June of 2020 as president emeritus with more narrowly defined roles, but overall a support and resource for the new president, is something we think will work well for the university. Obviously, that has to all transpire and unfold, but that's the approach that we took, and that we're hopeful for. So let me talk now, if that's what you'd like, about reiterating and bringing to life some of the factors and qualities that that the Governance and Policy Committee led us through at our September meeting, and that Jason Langworthy from our staff came and reported to you. And I'd note that the chair of the Governance and Policy Committee for the Board of Regents, which is a committee of the whole, all 12 of us, Regent Darren Rocious, here as well. And these factors have the, I think, the added benefit, perhaps for the first time in all the years that I've been on the board, which is approaching eight now, where we actually had the full board dialogue and discuss what these priorities and factors should be as you consider your own selection criteria. So I think that's good. We had a dialogue about it, and you had one report. Let me bring that to a little bit sharper focus with my own thinking on it, and starting with governance experience. I think that is critically important. We were careful not to say that it's a prerequisite, but I'd say it's as close to a prerequisite as it could be, knowing about and having a willingness to learn and understand what oversight of a large, complex institution is. It's got to be a prerequisite. It doesn't mean you have to have had experience doing it, but it sure helps. And if a region hasn't had experience in that, they've sure got to be open and willing to learn, because that's imperative. And I think that manifests itself perhaps most importantly in a strong recognition and appreciation for the difference between governance and management. And I can remember appearing before all of you in 2011 and again in 2017, and that was a pretty standard question that that you asked. And I dug into my background as a member of the leadership and senior executive team for a private sector company, and talked about how I could tell when I knew the governance management interface was working well, being on the management side of that. And that's the kind of experience I'm talking about, not necessarily having held a board seat, having made governance decisions, but some perspective at some level of a big, small, public, private, profit, not-for-profit organization, to have a sense of what does good governance feel like, whether it is to the public that watches us, the legislature that so importantly funds a sizable chunk of our operations, or to the staff and students and faculty that we lead. When you see good governance in action, everything works well. So understanding that that gray zone between management and governance, having a feel for that, I think is really important. And again, the board specifically in that dialogue with the Governance and Policy Committee was careful not to say it's a prerequisite. But I think as you look and talk to candidates, you know, finding some element of their background where whether they've been involved on the governance or the management side or in an organization where they've seen it work well, that's really helpful. So that's one. I think another that the board did put into these priorities is that the board should reflect the demographics of the state. not on a, you know, perfect ratio basis or anything else, but keep demographics squarely in mind. I think we believe it's important that we have at least some members of the board with firsthand background in education and an understanding of how academic institutions function. Again, the board didn't put any specific numbers on any of this, but that is an area that that is super helpful, and not all of us come from, in my own background, I didn't have any of that. No experience really whatsoever in that, and an understanding why the university, you know, I was told by many legislators, the university isn't a business. It never will be, and don't try to operate it like one. And that's been, you know, good experience for me, but on the other hand, understanding what academia is, what the three-part academic mission of our organization is, I think it's helpful when the board has at least a couple members who that's second nature to. So we did highlight that. We also highlighted the fact that we want members who are willing to learn and understand the complexity of the university and appreciating the significant time commitment that comes with it. And I'll stop and pause for a second on time. I think the official number is 25 to 30 hours, I'd say, for a regent that is not involved in committee leadership or in board leadership. I'd say it's probably closer to 40 to do the job right. That's always been my, you know, 25% time, and that covers everything from what I'll call the ceremonial or representative roles that we have, and those are amazing, by the way, whether it's a commencement for a graduation ceremony at UMD or an opportunity to provide a Regents Award to a philanthropist or an opportunity to recognize a student scholar. They're stunning and inspirational opportunities, but I add them to my time estimate of what it takes to do the job right, because it's really important to be seen and to participate, and you never get an understanding of what our university is and should be without participating in those. So there's the ceremonial work, and again, I don't mean to demean it when I call it that. It's just really important. There's classic governance work. Time today, for instance, a board member that wants to come prepared to our committee meetings tomorrow has somewhere between, on average, I'd say 300 to 400 pages of docket materials to work through. Now, 25 of those will be a long list of names and gifts, but you know, 80 to 90% of that will be substantive, meaty material about which the docket came out last Thursday. It was published on our devices and our iPads, and you need to get through that. So that's probably the bulk of that time, preparing for governance work, and then there's the actual governance work, and that's 8 meetings a year, and 6 of those come with full committees. So when I total all that up for a regent that isn't in a leadership role of a committee or the board, I easily get to that 25% number. And if you add to that leadership of a major committee, and we restructured our committees 2 years ago, so we have 3 committees of the whole now, and 2 audit and lit review that are committees of 6, but for the chairs of those committees, there's a significant additional increment. And if you look at leadership of the board, vice chair or chair, which now I'm going to stop and try to insert some humor, Dean Johnson told me I'd be bored as vice chair. That never happened. It easily doubles, if not triples at times, the work. So none of that is meant by way of complaint. It's an honor, a privilege, and an absolute joy and an inspiration to have these opportunities. But I think you need to really get an understanding of candidates that they're going to have somewhere between that 25% and, you know, call it 50 to 75, if somebody wants to move into leadership roles, committee maybe, you know, 50 approaching that, and board leadership something beyond that. Those are good, probing, important questions to ask, and getting you know, good, honest answers that somebody has the time and inclination to do what they need to do. Which brings me to another factor that we identified, and that is we're always interested in people. Not everybody comes on the board and wants to or is has the makeup to be a leader. But it's always good to try and identify people who want to step into these roles and pick up some of those leadership opportunities, because over a six-year term, there's going to be opportunities at the committee or the board level. And I'd suggest to you that teasing that out of people, not, you know, somebody that hasn't been a regent probably can't even make an informed decision about whether they'd ever like to pursue a leadership role on the board. But you can tell from looking at people's background and visiting them and interviewing them whether there's leadership potential and leadership interest there. So that'd be a factor. I think another key is understanding and demonstrating the ability to function as a team and recognizing and respecting differences. Obviously, for legislators and anybody that's done almost anything in life, we need to recognize and respect differences, and after doing so, understanding, investing the time it takes to know where a fellow regent is coming from and wants to head to, work together as a team for the university's long-term success. So I think demonstrated ability to build teams, to invest in, develop, and then nurture working relationships with people is really a paramount skill. And lastly, as far as factors go, I think asking about vision for the university over the next half to full decade is vitally important. And again, people's vision for the future is often framed by their experiences in the past. But hearkening back to my opening comments about the importance of this 2019 election and how the board will work in concert with a new president, this is a long-term commitment and a long-term perspective and vision for a regent's vitally important. And I think the long-term implications of every decision we make has to be part of the framework that we put into our heads and that we think about. And as you've watched us over the last year, 2 years, 3 years, we've, I think, focused with President Kaler much more on long-term planning and a much more system-wide perspective. And we've got work to do, and President Kaler is going to leave his successor with a nice platform around which to build. But I can almost guarantee you I won't be chair next year when we go to work on 2019-20 priorities, but I can almost certainly assure you that a system-wide strategic plan and building on the work that's been done will be one of the board's four or five criteria, and I'm pretty confident it'll match up with one of the new president's four or five criteria. So finding people that have a sense of the consequentiality of the decisions they're going to make and how that fits inside a vision that they might have is pretty darn important. So I'm hopeful that me trying to take a personal sense of that, personal in, bringing my experiences to light, but yet sticking to the framework that the full board talked about in terms of those key characteristics that Jason Langworthy brought to you back in September is helpful. And I would stop here and see if you've got questions for me. And I'm sure you're all interested in the presidential process. Hopefully I've outlined that, but I can tackle questions on that. And the other thing I have here, but I'm not going to go through unless you ask me to, is we put together some of, if I had to have a top five of some of the things we have accomplished, I've got that here too, but it isn't personal. It's just where do we stand today and what work needs to be picked up on. But I don't know if that's of interest to you or not. So let me stop, pause, grab a breath, and do some listening. And thanks for the opportunity to be here. So.
Chair McMillan, thank you very much for offering your perspective. Members, are there questions for the chairman? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Chair McMillan, for your service. And I think what you presented to us was very helpful. I had a reporter tell me before that they don't think that this is done enough in the region selection of what the needs are. One of the questions I have is what, and I'm new to this committee, is did you consider the makeup of the committee that you currently have? You mentioned something of the importance of somebody to have a background in academia and know about that well, and more than one person. What about, and this is really what I'm getting to and wondering what is needed as far as someone in the medical field and getting that could help raise the level and profile of our medical school?
Chair Walter and Representative Bernardi, great question. And yes, and we didn't exclude that. I think of all the disciplines that that come our way, we have been blessed over time with, you know, healthcare administrators and physicians. We don't currently have one with the departure of Regent and Dr. Simmons, but we have made a huge, in fact, our number one priority, far above system-wide strategic planning even, has been to develop the academic medicine, clinical research, healthcare delivery partnership with Fairview. And had you asked me that question 2 years ago, I would have said, I think the board either should have or, you know, maybe missed not putting that in their priorities. But where we stand today, and I'm going to be careful and try to make sure I answer this clearly, I feel better than I did 2 or 4 years ago about trying to navigate this path without that expertise on the board, because we've got a superb dean of the medical school who we have now through the new mHealth agreement with Fairview and the leadership of James Hereford. I think we're in very, very, very good shape right now in concert with the Fairview board, who together we're going to bring that mHealth agreement to life, to step back from a governance standpoint and let President Kaler and his successor, along with Dean Tolar, execute around the framework of what is really a wonderful agreement for the university. And it has to work for Fairview or it won't work for anybody. So let me summarize. I think before bringing that to a final head and getting the vote on that, I would have said, yeah, the medical piece is really critical. I think where we stand now, it's in execution mode, and regents should never be involved in execution mode. We should be always in governance mode and having the leadership team at the executive level to get the executing done. So that last comment was editorial in a way. That's my view. The board didn't, you know, vote on that or anything else, but I don't believe it's imperative. It's helpful, but it's not absolutely imperative that you add somebody from the medical profession. If you can and there's the right candidate there, great, but not as critical as it has been given where we stand with Fairview today.
Great, thank you.
Councilmember Hipsch.
Right? Chair McMillan, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you and the entire board for taking time to do the conversation, because I found that really helpful as we went through the process of looking at updating some of our materials that we're sending out. Kind of building on the last question, as you think of the composition as a whole of the Board of Regents, not necessarily a requirement, but more so, is there a skill set or two that by adding that to the board you think could make the overall process or the overall regents even more effective? Or is there a gap at anywhere where you'd say, boy, it'd be great to have a little bit more experience in this area for us to just keep in mind as we're looking through candidates?
You know, I fiscal or financial acumen, business experience, I tend to go there because of my makeup. But I said earlier that I think I was quoting Representative former Representative Tom Rukavina, who told me 100 times, "Don't the university's not a business, don't run it like one." I think Tom would be okay with me saying that here, and he'd probably put more emphasis on it than I did. But having said that, I still jump back to that whole range of disciplines that I equate to business acumen that I think are always helpful. But we're not missing that. We've got a fair amount of that. We've got strong legal backgrounds there now. We are our presidential candidate finalist, and we'll see where that all goes in the week ahead. But we're looking for those similar characteristics there. So I don't think there's any other discipline I would hold up. Medical certainly is great, but again, I've answered that it isn't absolutely required. And the education arena, wherever it might be, K-12, higher ed, is sure helpful. So I'm going to stick with what the board, because the board labored over this for a while, and I think that's a pretty fair one. I'm stopping and looking down because I'm kind of going through my head what is missing, but nothing else that I, as board chair speaking for the board, would raise up. I've given you my personal sense, and that is always love the business experience and acumen.
Thank you. Additional questions?
Chairman McMillan, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had a smile when you talked about percentages of time requirement. You would go up to, you didn't quite get to 100%, but I'm certain that you, yourself, and many of your colleagues in this last iteration of finding a new president went way beyond 100% of what would be a normal work week. So we thank you for that. So we don't tell prospective candidates or leaders on the board about that because it would probably scare them off. But
yeah.
But I'm sure that you were exceeded that. You asked us to teed us up for what you have accomplished on the board, and in your position, you hear all the time about what you didn't do or should do. I think it'd be valuable, and this committee would be appreciative, and the public would be appreciative of hearing your own summary of what has been accomplished, the good. At the university in your chairmanship and before.
Well, thank you, Chair Walters and Mr. Erickson, for that recognition. It is appreciated. And as I peel off a couple of these again, this was not vetted by the full board, and I say it with absolute deep and sincere recognition and realization that none of this happens without President Kaler and the leadership team at the university over his time. He will leave this university in a better place than he got here, and we're deeply grateful to him for that. But as I think about where we've partnered with the administration, the Kaler administration, to make a difference, I'm really pleased that our resident tuition rates have risen less than the rate of inflation. Now, there's some on the board that wouldn't consider that a win till they're flat or decreasing, but I don't ever apologize for where we stand since President Kaler came here and forward in terms of our resident tuition. And we're getting at a long-standing and long-standing challenge to better address the in-state and out-of-state tuition gap, which was very small and is now, I think, moving in the right direction. So tuition's a big deal, and that none of that happens without the legislature to step up and fund some of those early tuition deals that President Kaler championed. And I'm hopeful that we can continue in 2019-20 to keep those resident tuition rates extremely low, if not flat at times. So, one, tuition outcomes. Two, our Fairview partnership. I talked about that. The opportunity to reinvest in our medical school. And again, legislative and gubernatorial support for the asset side of that equation with a new medical school coming. Those are huge. Probably nothing more consequential in 20 years looking back than what was done with this mHealth partnership. And again, a handful of names over at the university, President Kaler and Dean Tolar and our Executive Vice President Brian Burnett, our
Provost Hanson and our general counsel, Doug Peterson, all names that that conversation can't happen without. This one's premature, but I feel like we're getting moving on a more of a system-wide look. There's regents in the room that have made that a priority. It's always been a priority for me, but bringing that to life in terms of we have a system, what do we do with it? So that would be a third. A fourth would be, I think we're, and again, Eric Kaler's been excellent in this regard, but what is a land-grant university in this state, which has a unique mix of deeply rural elements and this wonderful, culturally vibrant, and very, very large urban metropolis? And I think our dialogue at the board and with the administration is beginning to focus on, as we now are, what, coming up on two decades into the 21st century, what does that land-grant mission look like? It can and has to serve both of those, but that fits in with that system piece. It's an overused cliche to say we're a 21st century land-grant school. I think defining what that means in the particular geography and socioeconomic makeup of this state is really important, and I feel like we're doing more of that today than we were. And then lastly, and this is regents before me that had the foresight to do this and to recognize that with President Kaler we have a someone who responds to and really loves metrics, the progress card. So those are the maroon and gold measures that you see. And I think the university was on not the leading edge of academia, but they were pressing the boundaries when those came into being. And I think the next challenge now is that's a laundry list of things, the maroon and gold measures. If you get a chance to take a look at them, I think that the next thing we need to do is figure out, with a new president, of course, what's the right go-forward set of strategic and objective measures and metrics around which we should help steer the university forward, with the president in the lead, executing again, and us in a governance mode. But those are five things that jump out at me. There's probably, you know, 50 more that that any individual regent would have, but I don't take personal credit for one of those, but I'm proud of those things when I look back that the board did with President Kaler. Thank you for asking.
Thank you. All right, Regent McMillan, thank you very much for your time today. I know you've got a busy rest of the week, so we appreciate your spending some time with us, and also thank you for your service. We understand, you know, you explained a lot of the role of a regent, so we thank you. And I know Regent Roche is in the audience too, so we understand those are not paid positions. You do it all completely out of service, and we really appreciate it. So
thank you. It's an honor.
Thank you again. Okay, with that, we're going to move on to committee reports. Kathy Madsen, chair of the Selection Criteria Committee.
So in your packets are the updated materials. Not sure which one it is. Thanks. Yeah. The selection procedures. Selection criteria. This one. Yeah. I have two procedures, so I don't know if I have one. Anyways, thank you. So we at the last meeting had a discussion about the selection criteria, and the committee got together, and thank everybody for their input. I got some input by email as well as on the committee. And we also spent some time listening to the governance committee meeting that Regent McMillan had referenced, where they had some input and some dialogue about what they felt was important for the criteria when we're selecting candidates. And all of that was distilled, and we updated these criteria. These are the ones that we sent out along with a few changes that we made to the application form itself for the applicants to fill out. So I guess what we need right now is to formally adopt these. We use them as a recommendation for formal adoption today through this process. And I would entertain any questions that people have about the changes we made.
Representative Bernardi.
Are you able to just share with me, are there any differences from what Chair McMillan had said that their goals were versus what's in here? You said it sounds like you had those in advance, you incorporated them. Is there anything that's left out that the regents suggested?
I don't think so. We we spent a fair time, like I said, listening to the governance committee, and we took what we felt were the key points and then worked them into these comments. So I don't believe that there was anything that was discussed as a priority from that meeting that didn't get incorporated into here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Additional questions on those? And we need a motion then to adopt those, correct?
Yes. A motion to adopt.
Moved. It's been moved. Second. Moved and seconded. Additional discussion on selection criteria. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Selection criteria. Thank you. That was a lot of advance work before the last meeting and between meetings, so appreciate that. Now, the next report is the reference check interview process committee. I think some of you may remember that the reference check process in particular was one that we had made a priority to rethink and to revisit. And I'm going to turn it over to Tim Hirsch. I struggle with your name. I'm sorry. The chair of that committee to talk about their work.
Thank you so much. In front of you, or in the packet, you see a copy of what the committee came back with as a proposed reference checking piece. And I'm going to break the comments into two parts. First part we'll talk about is a reference checking piece. Just to give everyone a little bit of background on this, as Chair Walter had mentioned, this was a priority for us this year to look at and say, okay, how do we relook at how we do references? And really taking into account a lot of the conversations that we heard through the last cycle and from legislative staff, what could we do to ensure consistency as we looked at references. In prior years, there was at times some members would get a couple references, other members might have a larger number of references checked. Some we weren't able to get a hold of references on, so it just made it really hard to be able to both track that as well as the time period that we're going into here, because reference checks have to be completed before we reconvene in January. Given the holidays, just being able to find references availability has been challenging. So what you have in front of you is a revised process, and I'll walk us through that process just briefly. So because in the past and historically we've asked that all of the comments be in written form, so as our members would reach out and talk to the reference, we would then transcribe that into written form. We thought, is there an opportunity for us to ask the references themselves to put it into a written form and submit it for our review? So what we've identified is going forward, having each candidate, we reach out to two references via email, asking those references to submit that information back within a two-week period, giving them an opportunity to say from the beginning, boy, I'm not going to have a chance to get to this, so that we could move on to a secondary reference. But we would choose two references for each of the candidates. The staff would identify those two references, circulate it to the entire committee here for feedback and saying, is there someone in that we would prefer to have for a reference different than what it is? And then effective so in this year's time period, we'll finalize, okay, who are we going to be talking to in the meeting today? We'll send out either later today, or Sally will later today, the listing of saying, okay, here are the two references we're anticipating for that candidate. Give this board through the end of the week to give us some feedback on if there's anyone we want to switch out. An email will go out to those references next Monday, giving them the deadline of the 27th of December to have that turned around and sent back. We'll have a chance to send a reminder the week before, and then also give us a chance to have a little bit of time to reach out if they have not responded on the 28th, by the 27th. built into the process is also an opportunity for the executive committee to say, hey, boy, we want to dive a little bit deeper into a reference, and at their direction, a phone conversation can be set up with that reference. All of the process that you see in front of you is a combination of the work the committee did, and recognize Member Brady, Member Wakefield for joining me on that. We've had a chance to vet this through both Senate and House legal staff, just to make sure everything's in alignment with processes. Everyone signed off on it. You know, I think there will be learnings as we go through, because this is a pretty big change from what we've had in prior years. But I think it really does get after a lot of the feedback we had heard, and ensures that we have good consistency going forward. So with that, I'll pause and ask for any questions.
And I just want to reiterate to the part of the reason this was necessary is a desire to bring consistency to the process. I think in the past we have volunteered, I think, generally to do the reference check. We as individual council members have volunteered to do reference checks for individuals, and that can range anything from, you know, I mean, it's very subjective based on the person doing it. The goal here is to really provide some consistency to the process. I've got a question, though, and it might be Sally or a staff related. Can you refresh us as part of this process? What is public information? What is public information was not in this process?
Chair Walter,
you weren't anticipating that.
Yep. None of it is public information. All the reference information is classified as private data.
That was an easy question. See, good. Any questions for Tim? Councilmember England.
Thank you. I would just note that when we proceed with reference checks, that obviously is communicated to the reference that is private, because, you know, I think that your first question might be who's going to see it.
That's a good point.
And in the email that would go out to them, it very clearly calls that fact out. And if any of the references would have a question and be able to respond, we would reaffirm that fact that it is private.
Councilmember Carlson.
Yes, I sent this question to you. Is there going to be any caveat or caution to the person filling out the reference that they're not to go back to the candidate and ask the candidate to fill that out? And call me jaded at 75, but I think that there might be the tendency, if you didn't offer that caution. That's one thing I communicated to you. The other I didn't. I thought about overnight. If the public would like to provide any input, would you want to seek any public input? And the reason I ask is 2 years ago, even after we checked references in the second congressional district, some of the information did not come up that was confirmed by a source. Would you ever want to consider that? It's just an idea, the second part. The first one I am more concerned about.
Yeah. You know, I think there's always the potential for a candidate asking or providing information that would go into that reference. I think in some ways you want to have some information. So if you have a reference that is looking for a little bit more context to be able to include in their reference, you might have a need to want to reach back out to that candidate. But the intent isn't for a candidate to be writing their reference. I would leave it at that. I would certainly open to ideas of how we message that. But for the level of role we're asking a person to serve on the Board of Regents, that would, in my mind, be an expectation that is they're putting forward references that can speak to their complete body of work. One of the questions that you'll see in there is also, you know, tell us about your strengths and your weaknesses. And I would hope that candidates are choosing references that can objectively share, you know, what are those strengths and weaknesses, because we all have strengths and weaknesses as we look at service. With regards to the second part, that piece had not come up on, you know, opening it up to the public. This is a very public process. As we go beyond this, all the way into the joint committees and the convention. So I think there is a large amount of opportunity for greater public public input.
I think Councilmember Brady.
Thank you, Chair Walter. I served on this committee with Tim, and probably my biggest concern when we looked at the new procedure was losing that opportunity for a spontaneous, contemporaneous conversation where you can have a response and something occurs to you and it's a bit more free-flowing. I think that's probably the biggest thing we give up. There is, however, a lot of things that I see as very pro about this and better as it relates to the procedure. I have participated in a number of those questions to those references, and one of the first things that's just a practical reality is we're about to move into the holiday season. Getting somebody on the phone often is very difficult, and having them be prepared to give real thoughtful feedback. I've reached people at bowl games when they're in the parking lot tailgating that have given their opinion to me. The other thing I like about it is there's a little less filtering of that information. So I'd say perhaps more objectivity. Every reference is presented by and through the lens and filter of an RCAC member rather than getting the information directly from the font of the reference. I also believe it gives the person who's providing the reference an opportunity to give more thoughtfulness to their response and put it forward in a way that's perhaps more meaningful than what would happen in a spontaneous, contemporaneous conversation. And then I also finally believe that there's more consistency with respect to the overall pack of responses on the references. So for those reasons, I thought this was a good idea and I support it, and I appreciate Tim, your work on this committee and leading us through this.
Councilmember Farrell.
Thank you. Not an easy task to sort out and make a recommendation to all of us that's good. I appreciate, and this is my second rotation, and I appreciate the concern about consistency. When I was at the meeting last time and everybody was saying, I'll check that fellow's or that gal's reference or whatever. We were all very cautioned about the privacy and all, and I just recognize that it would be a very uneven set of conversations if 24 people were all calling and getting, you know, these different. So the concern and consistency, I appreciate. What I see that's sort of still missing from that, and maybe I shouldn't expect it to come forward in the reference checking, but there were two candidates last time that I learned important things about them in the newspaper that did not come through our reference checks, did not come through their application process, did not come forward because of anything we knew. And I was a little thunderstruck by it. We went through this whole process, and I'm reading about this in the newspaper. It disadvantaged us as a committee, information we didn't know. It disadvantaged the candidates. It wasn't there. They didn't have an opportunity to present to us their explanation or answers to what the things that we learned. And so there's a lot of public information available to us. And so maybe I want reference checking to give me something that maybe I shouldn't expect reference checking to give me. I've done a lot of work in nonprofit sector, in a lot of board nonprofit work, and we routinely had a set of criteria of things that we would look that public information on the internet. We would sort of profile a potential donor and to recognize their capacity to support our organization. You can learn a lot about somebody about from all the public information that's out there about them. And had we done something like that, I think we would have not looked as uninformed as we did last time. So it's maybe not I was expecting that to come forward in our reference checking, and I think maybe I think this is what reference checking is, but somewhere I would like to see an independent validation about some of the criteria things about our candidates. I don't want to read about it in the paper. I think we can do a better job of vetting candidates. That's my two cents.
Mr.
Chairman, two-part, we're talking about two things. First of all, I greatly commend the committee for this streamlining our reference check policy, because now we're going to pick, the staff picks a couple, and the referenced person that is obviously supportive of the candidate, they wouldn't list them as a reference unless they were supportive. I think that they'll, if they're thoughtful, and they will be, that what comes back will be helpful to us analyzing. We'll learn more than we learn just on the name that they're a reference. So, and two, I think is fine, and letting our staff check. I think that's a very positive thing. You know, we've all spent a lot of time calling people and over the holidays, and they all say good things about the people they were, that were they're listed on. So I think this is more effective, more efficient, and more strategic for us, and more valuable. On the, that's the reference check. The background check is what yes. Member Farrell and Member Carlson are talking about.
Right.
And I think there's two ways we could think about addressing that. One is we, I believe, publish by a press release the names of the people that we are going to interview. So when we finish today, there will be a published list that probably hopefully widely distributed that these 25 or whatever number we pick are going to be interviewed, whatever that number turns out to be. And I think in that, I would suggest we think about in that press release, putting a line in there that anyone wanting to comment on this list of people can do so, and maybe I would funnel them into the staff and make it private, and the staff can do it. I'm just thinking about that. That lets somebody say, oh, I didn't know this person was a candidate. That's number one. And then number two, I don't know who's going to do this, but as Member Farrell indicated, if last time in the particular instance that Margaret is talking about, somebody had done a deep dive in Google to almost anybody, those things would have come out. Now, I don't know that that's our job, but you can find out a lot these days about people that don't show up on their application, and I'm just saying it's an opportunity. It's kind of like when you look at the newspaper story and the comments, you know, people fire in their positive and negative comments. So I don't know if there's a mechanism, but we might think about some invitation, or certainly don't want to assign Sally to Google every client, but somewhere we might think about that, because there's nothing private almost anymore. And I think if we'd done that 2 years ago, we would have been surprised.
The example that you're giving there from the, not to dive into specific cases, but that second district one that...
That was the one I was referring to.
Yeah. So I was the one that received press calls about that, and I did Google it the day I got those calls, and it was, you know, it was something that happened in the 70s. There were no court records, so it. I think if you do now, the public record would be the news articles from that. So I like where you're going on the when you post the names, doing something to solicit some you know. Feedback, but and again, would that be that? I'm assuming would be private data as well. If you solicit public comments on candidates.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Chair, to clarify, it was the second congressional district that I was referring to. And so I do think just a line that if public has comment, they can comment. That fulfills what my need is. And that probably clarifies what Barb is talking about as well.
You also may remember we did add a application question based on this, the self-disclosure question was intended for this because of this type of situation too. So additional comments? Back to the reference checks. Did I digress? Yes, Senator Clausen. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking one option might be to do a third-party professional background check on candidates. I mean, if this is something that the board like to consider? I'm just throwing that out for consideration.
I'm sorry, Kathy distracted me.
I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
I distracted him so he didn't
I missed
hear.
Your comment.
I was just saying that one option that we may want to consider is to do a third-party professional background check on candidates, taking it out of our hands, but having a third party do that and then providing that information to us.
That I think that's primarily a budget matter. Mm-hmm. That was definitely, you might remember, I was in front of your committee last year, too, with the reference check question that came up. I think that's a valid thought. Right now, I think this approach is actually tapping our staff resources to their extent, the form. But I think that would be a good idea in the future to consider.
Good.
Anybody else have thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman?
Council Member Erickson.
Would a thought be, as you recall, we're now not going to assign references to the committee members. I mean, like the calls that we had to make. Now we're going to tell people, send us, that was going to, so we were relieved of that burden. A thought might be that there's 24 members. Let's say we have 20. Each one of us could be assigned one person to do the Google search. You know, it's a thought. At least you'd find about it. I don't know. That's not a heavy burden on us. It saves the money, and it's not a professional job, but it might turn out something. That's a thought. I don't have that motion.
Tim, did you have a thought?
The only caution I would have there, and this is kind of with an HR hat on from an organization, is all the information on the internet isn't necessarily true or defined. So you could be getting false positives. You could get misinformation. I don't know if that necessarily is a fair portrayal of an individual just by Googling and then taking, oh, I have one article that says one thing.
Right.
Therefore, this is a qualified candidate. I'm not sure that would stand up.
Point taken. So.
Senator Paulson.
Just a kind of a tongue-in-cheek. We do have Representative Bernardi and Senator Anderson here who chair the committees and have a budget, you know, that they could...
They have a checkbook.
Good. Oh, Senator.
I apologize to my colleagues.
Councilmember Farrell.
And I would love to explore that idea a little bit. We talk about budget, and I have no sense of what that budget would be. To do a background, independent professional background check on, say, 30 candidates or whatever the number would be. My only experience, even close to, would be I volunteer at our high school, and they do a background check on us before we can be approved as to work with the students at the high school. We have to sign a check a box that we say we know that they're doing it. And in fact, then they ask us to fund the price of our background check. So, and I think it was $35 through the school district. So that was our contribution, and it was modest enough that you don't hesitate to do it, because you certainly do want the people who are walking through your high school these days to have been checked out. So I don't know if that, you know, my guess is, and I've not researched it, but background checks can probably be that kind of background check or much more extensive. But if we even started with that kind of a background check, you know, less than $50 per candidate, whatever.
Sally, did you have?
So would that be like a criminal background check?
You know, I don't remember the form I signed. It was a while ago, but it's in Prairie High School, and it's a standard procedure. If you're going to volunteer there, you need to permit them to do this kind of background.
I think that's something that could possibly be looked into. The issue of adding, something to the application,
right,
getting permission from the applicant to do such a background check came up a couple of years ago, and at that time, advice was kind of given that there was a theme of, like, it was called ban the box and to not move forward with putting those on an application. Okay. But
I don't know.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, that was at that time was the thought being these are public enough positions too that the
that the information would come forward.
Yeah, exactly.
But
it proved to be a challenge
last time in an untimely fashion. So,
I remember the year it came up, actually, there was an applicant who had self-disclosed something in a question that didn't ask for that necessarily. So that was, had brought the discussion up at that point.
But I do think adding when you print the list, if anyone has any information confidentially that they would like to pass on to the RCAC staff in private, put it in, see how it works. And if it doesn't work, we get hit again. Then I like the suggestion that Senator Clausen made, but we probably don't need to do it this year.
Councilmember Brady.
Thank you, Chair Walter. Certainly, I want to be vigilant and diligent in my process here. I think I've been through four or five cycles. I have to say that instance was particularly concerning. I share that concern. But what I sometimes think about is I think that was the only instance that we had like that. And periodically, I think, no? Mm-hmm. Well, but I don't want to have the exception make the rule. I also believe that if we put that background in there, if another body came in, a third party, and they didn't get something done, suddenly we'd be treating similarly situated people dissimilarly, which is a trip line for us, I think, in terms of our process. So I too think that what Jim has proposed and what Margaret has sort of seconded in the conversation is a good solution. I'm concerned that if we went to a third party, it may have that budgetary issue. I'm concerned that it would have a trip line, as I described. And so I like the less administratively burdensome recommendation from that side of the table.
Jim, do you have additional?
No, you know, I think it's all been really good in the feedback. I think trying to get a background component fit in for this cycle would be really hard given our time frame. So I guess what I would ask Chair Walter is let's keep that on the list for things to consider as we look at the next cycle of saying, okay, let's see how this process works from the references side, and then make a determination of do we need to go deeper from a background side. With regards to adding the line kind of open public to send in requests, I think we just would have to think through the process of okay, how do we collect collate that information and get it back out, and does it go out? Does every piece that come in go back to the entire committee? Does it go to the executive committee and then kind of synthesize? We would have to think through some of that pieces of it. But again, I think that's separate from the reference check piece of it.
I'd have a good point. I'd have a suggestion about that. If we put the line on the disclosure and encourage people, and Sally's the point of contact, here's an address and you can do that, then I think the we can have her and delegate you as the chair committee to, if she feels, to report to you what she found. And if then you have some concern, I trust your judgment about whether it's legitimate or not, and you can then decide to bring it to your committee. Work it up. I don't think we need to take it farther. That my view would be I'd authorize to you and the chair to see what you learned, and if you thought it rose to a level of needing further, fine. If you don't, because there will be false positives, yes. No question about that. We know that. But so I don't think we all need to vet that. But that's a funnel that I would suggest if we put the line in there, and I hope we do encourage people and see what happens. It's a good test for this year.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My suggestion is, since we're not going to do it, sounds like we're not going to do it this cycle, to have, like, I don't know how you do this, a work group or whatever, look at what are the best practices. There has to be some other groups that have come up with a good solution for this. So that's what I would recommend.
No, that's a good suggestion. We'll I lost a thought there. So on this, we don't need a motion for this necessarily, right, or do we?
I'd move to delegate to the executive committee the solution to this. Do what you think best and let this executive committee do that.
Which I think is kind of how it happens without a motion, but is there a second?
Question, yes.
I just have a concern about opening it up with a statement anyone can reply. I mean, my colleagues during the session, we get hundreds of emails and with all kinds of accusations many times. You can end up chasing your tail trying to sort these out, what is true, what is false. So it's just a cautionary note that that's a possibility, probably a strong possibility that that'll happen.
Correct. And I think we're acknowledging this is going to be a learning process through this one. I do think it addresses the initial concerns, but we have some work to do in terms of seeing how it functions. Because I agree, it would be very easy to send anonymous emails, and then we have to kind of figure out what's the credibility there. The other thing I think we're missing in this discussion is we are really the first step in this process. We then send the names to a committee. I mean, they're very public after. More public after our process, and then they go to legislative committees, and there are other hands on this process. Not that I'm trying to pass the buck, but it's that's important to note too. It's not we're not a hiring authority here. So anyway, okay, Representative Bernardi.
I just want to add one more comment to that, and possibly we just need to be transparent and let the people we pass this on to, legislators or whatever, what kind of background check was done, wasn't done, just so that there's transparency, so people aren't assuming, oh, you had that covered, why didn't you tell us that you didn't?
Right.
Just create transparency.
And we are fortunate to have a lot of staff in the audience listening to this discussion, so. Okay, so that ends that item then. Or did we have a motion on the floor?
I would renew my motion that we delegate to the executive committee to address this issue in the way they think best and to act, authorize them to act as they choose.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Is that you?
It was.
Moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Interview questions.
Yep. So real quick, second sheet is the interview process and questions. This one went through a fair amount of revision last cycle, so not mention a change. The only addition that was added is under question number one, we wanted to call out the University of Minnesota a land grant institution. Mm-hmm. Other than that, no other changes to the interview questions that will be posed.
And for those new members, this is not these are very much suggested questions. We don't go through the line of questions. It's really just as you're putting your thought processes together during the interview, these are the options. You can go beyond that, obviously. These are just in case we get here and 24 people don't know what to ask. anything else on that? Mr. Chair.
That's it. And just for clarity, so the executive committee then will take on the topic of, okay, how do we ask for potentially broader feedback? But the reference checking process as we have laid out here is the way we'll move forward for this year.
That makes sense. Okay. Thank you. That was a vibrant discussion. We will move on to the recruitment committee report. Vice Chair Taylor.
Thank you. In your folder is multiple ways of looking at the 46 applications that we have received. So please take note of that. I want to begin by thanking Margaret Carlson, Jim Erickson, Barb Farrell, Megan Olson, Dan Walters for his wonderful op-ed, and most importantly, Sally Olson for all of their help with our recruitment. I did not take the time to follow up with Sally to find out how this cycle ranks, but I think it's pretty strong. You would all agree that having 46 applications is very positive. I think it's a strong pool. Hopefully each of you have had an opportunity to review the individual applications. I want to give Megan Olson a shout out. I can't remember, this is only my second cycle with students, but I think having 14 checking a student box is world class. What's really nice is we've got applicants from four of our six campuses, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and Morris. And so we'll just have to work harder in 6 years in Crookston and Rochester so that we can be six out of six. I think very positive in terms of diversity, gender, ethnicity, geography, work experience. We have public sector, healthcare, government, nonprofit, private businesses, small, medium, and large. So if we missed something that you thought was important, my apologies on behalf of the committee, but I think we're going to have a unique opportunity today to review a very strong pool of applicants for our four open positions: 6 year student at large, two at large positions, and then the fifth congressional district. So that's my report.
Thank you, Paul. I do want to so just for a schedule perspective here, I'm gonna go through the procedures for selection of interviewees process, and then we're gonna do a recess for people to use the restroom or other soda refills, that sort of thing. And then we'll come back after that.
Just as a point of personal privilege, and I want to thank Paul for this. I think, in my recollection, my five times, I think the 46 is our record. So well done across all the boards. So I want to, but I'd like to just take a moment to introduce three students that I have in the that are sitting in the back up here. They are Carleton College interns that are working with me and my firm at the Capital State Capitol for these 3 weeks. This is their last week. They're called externs, but I call them interns. They have followed the legislative process. They've gotten very hands-on in terms of delegating, and they've been very sensitive to this process because I'm involved. They've gotten very much involved. So I want to introduce them. First of all, Junior Catherine Rigney from Massachusetts. Stand up, Catherine. You can stand up. Uh-huh. Sophomore Jared Margolis from Texas. And sophomore Wendy Erickson, no relation, from Michigan. But they're here. They've learned a lot about this process. We like to say they couldn't get into the University of Minnesota, so they had to go to Carleton.
So, Jim, you should give two of the three of them a shout-out because they were with you and I a week ago today at the Boy Scout Leadership Breakfast in St. Paul. So, Wendy and Jared, good to see you again.
Indeed, they were, and they're going to leave now and go up and go to work on some legislation for the Boy Scouts. So, thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming.
Thank you, and thanks for coming, and you're learning from the best there, so we appreciate that. So again, I just not to repeat what Jim said, I want to thank Paul and the recruitment committee. I know I know all of the members of that committee were very aggressive in reaching out to individuals to make sure they were aware of the openings and to recruit candidates. And it really struck me when I started delving into the applications what a strong pool this is in terms of some of the challenges we've had in the past on gender and diversity issues as well. So I appreciate that. So just as background, in the past we have traditionally interviewed 14 to 16 candidates for the four seats. We're not wedded to that number, and I know there's a number of people that think that we should be interviewing more, definitely considering the strength of this pool. That's kind of where I think I'm at personally. In the past we have they've been 45-minute interviews. We've discussed potentially changing that time length to get more in. Obviously, this year we have the student position as well that has a number of 14 applications as well, which, you know, my experience traditionally has been in the student applicants. It's a little you don't get it quite as much from the application as you do from the interviews, so that might be something to consider. But I'm going to just quickly go through how we approach this voting process. But before that, we got one of the applicants on here was a late applicant, and we have traditionally, and I don't think particularly, I don't think too late, like Monday after a Friday deadline. So to accept, and that's, should I say the name? Number 9, James Carey, is the applicant. So I... I'd like to put it to the council. We usually take a motion and a vote to accept a late application.
Can
I believe that's the only one.
Take a look at our list before we vote?
If you'd like.
Is he on the list?
It's number 9. Again, this is just to accept the application.
Oh, okay.
You've reviewed the material.
Yes, I've reviewed the material.
So I wanted
to see what I had done.
It's really more of a formality thing, but again, we have deadlines for a reason, so if people want to respect that, I understand, but I wanted to put it before the council to consider. So is there, we would need a motion to accept that one additional application.
I'll move it. So
it's been moved. Is there a second? Moved and second. Any discussion? Seeing none. Oh, Jerry.
I guess we'll just comment that we've done this previously. In fact, we had someone that ended up as a regent. That was a last minute application. So this is not.
I think
precedent.
It has been. I don't know that we've not done this in the past. But
right.
Any other discussion on this before we vote? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, so the list you have is the list we have. So for those of you that haven't been through this process before, there is in your packet, it says on the top right corner, Exhibit 11. I'm not sure exactly why, but that's a good marker for you. Exhibit 11, just ignore the other 10. The voting will be done by ballot, and the sequencing is listed in the agenda. We'll vote the student at large first, and then the district position, and then the at-large seats last. Those of you who've been here before know that that's obviously everybody is eligible for the at-large seats, so that potentially there may be some usage of that process to. What am I looking for word-wise there? Sometimes there are people, you know, we might reach the maximum or something for a congressional district. So, Sally, would you like to offer a more authoritative?
Sure. So, as you may know, applicants are eligible to apply for multiple seats. They can apply for, if they live in the 5th district, they're also eligible for the at-large. And if they're a student that lives in the 5th district, they're eligible to apply for the student position, the 5th district position, and the at-large position. So somebody may not be selected to interview for, say, the 5th district position, but they might have also wanted to be considered for the at-large position. So they would also be on that ballot as well. So we can remove people from the at-large while we're live if they do get selected for a student position interview or a 5th district interview.
There, that was much more.
Mr. Chair, procedural
question. Councilmember Otto.
Are they eligible for the other positions if they did not indicate on their application materials they were interested in those other positions?
Sally, would you like to remind the
Chair Walter, members? So that would be up to this body to determine if the body thinks that they would like to consider everybody for the at-large, whether they check the box or not, or whether they believe that people should just be considered for the seat with which they selected.
Councilmember Erickson.
Thank you. I hear, since I talk to legislators a lot, I hear a lot about this. I would suggest that yes, they are eligible, but I'd suggest that we in this body respect where they applied for. And take to the 5th district, for example. We only vet the number of people that applied for the 5th district. We know the legislature changes. And I think it gets a little complicated for us to do that. So my suggestion would be, you know, that we only think about and respect how they applied. The multiple ones, I guess it's a little tricky, but if they only applied for one, that's my view, because the legislature has and will, not what has and can, switch people. We've recorded somebody from the at-large and somebody for a district, and they've turned it around, and I think that's their pay grade kind of past ours.
Well, and we ultimately, in the recommendations that we make, that's a separate process.
That's
well.
A separate, right, yeah. I'm just saying that's what
for
I think
initial,
will happen. Initially, for us.
Determining interviewees, I think
yeah.
typically it has been
right.
respectful of the forms.
I think,
I don't know that that's 100% true, but.
At this stage.
So that's not the most clear answer, but.
For what it's worth, that's the answer.
Okay. So the voting will be done by ballot. I explained the order. On the first ballot, you can vote for up to six, and this is all spelled out in the selection criteria, or in the selection procedures. On the first ballot, you can vote for up to six applicants. You don't have to. You can vote for up to six, so you can do fewer. A simple majority of votes qualifies an applicant for an interview, so that would be a majority of who's here, correct? Those applicants that receive no votes will be eliminated from the second ballot. On the second ballot, then, you can vote for up to four applicants. A third and final ballot may be conducted, but only upon the vote of a majority of members present. So ideally, after that second ballot, we should have a list. But there is some flexibility to do a majority vote to do the third ballot. And then, of course, Section D does allow suspension of the rules with the support of two-thirds of the members present, which those of you who've been through this know that sometimes that's needed, particularly in the past when we've had, I think we changed the rules to make it members. In the past, it was two-thirds of the total members, so when we had fewer appointees, we were in a little bit of a, we had to suspend rules because we didn't have enough votes regardless of who's here. Anyway, I don't mean to digress on that. So then when we come back, we will open, we will go through the pile of applications, the list here, in order, and then open the floor to discussions. Jerry.
Well, I just had a question.
Council Member Rogers, sorry.
Regarding the people that we forward to the legislature, when we vote, those numbers of votes do not go forward to the legislature. They do not go forward with a preference or recommendation. They just submit this as names.
Well, this is just to select people for interviewing, correct?
Okay.
So, but
I'm ahead of the game.
You're ahead of the game, yeah. But we'll discuss that at a later time, okay. Because we do have options on what to do there. We've always agreed. So anything more that we, Representative Bernardi.
I do have a question about this. It's been brought up on this committee, our recommendations that we have the regents reflect what Minnesota looks like. You don't always know by application, mm-hmm. someone's, if they have a disability or their gender or their ethnicity. So that's just, how does that handled on this committee?
That is one of the challenges that we have, because that's not, we've discussed in the past asking those questions, haven't we? But it's been.
Chair Walter.
Yes.
I've been on the committee for 10 years, and the male female is easily identified, you know, it, although I had to look up, was Kelly Doran on Google a man or a woman? I did not know that. Most of the candidates, if they have some disability or they are representing a population, they let you know through your answers. And I carefully went through all of these applicants, and many candidates did tell us. And as we talk about them, we can share that with you. Those of us who, because I know you just got your packets, but a number of us have had the advantage of a few days. So, but the question is there a check on that 2 years from now that someone can indicate that?
Sally, do you have any background? We discussed that a number of years ago, right? But we will. I'm sorry, I don't want to digress on this. But yeah, as you'll see as we go through the applications to the, there is a lot of, usually somebody here will know the individual or have some background. So that makes sense.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a brief recess. We also, former chair Ardell Brady's wife passed away.
Oh.
We have a sympathy card up here for those of you that would like to sign and extend your best wishes. Otherwise, we are, let's come back at 10:45. Does that give everybody enough time?
Is it not working?